This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. On December 6th, Dave Brubeck will celebrate his 90th birthday. 56 years ago, polls in the two leading jazz magazines, Metronome and Downbeat, selected Dave Brubeck's group as the best instrumental group of the year. That same year, Brubeck himself was the second jazz musician ever to be featured on the cover of Time magazine. The first was Louis Armstrong. And last year, Brubeck was saluted as an honoree by the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. Though Dave Brubeck no longer performs internationally, he still tours regularly across the United States. This week, he was at the Blue Note in New York City. And on Monday, Turner Classic Movies will premiere Clint Eastwood's documentary In His Own Sweet Way, which chronicles Brubeck's life and music. Terry Gross spoke with Dave Brubeck in 1999 when several of his classic recordings were re-released on CD. To set the mood, let's listen to his composition Three to Get Ready from the classic Time Out album, an album that illustrated the group's approach to counterpoint and eccentric rhythms. Paul Desmond is featured on alto saxophone, Eugene Wright on bass, and Joe Morello on drums.
Dave Brubeck, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Now, you grew up in Concord, California. Your mother was a classical piano teacher. Did she give you lessons?
Yeah. I had two older brothers, Henry and Howard, that also took lessons from my mother, and half the community, the people interested in piano, studied with her.
Was it hard to study with your mother?
Yeah. It wasn't so bad for my brothers, but I kind of rebelled.
How and why?
How and why? I wanted to be like my father, who was a cattleman and a rodeo roper. And he was my hero, and I wanted to be more like him. So my mother allowed me to stop taking lessons when I was 11. And we moved to a 45,000-acre cattle ranch where I spent my last year in grammar school and my high school years. And all summer I worked with my father. Then I went off to college to study veterinary medicine.
Oh, in the hope that you'd be a help on the ranch?
Yeah, so I could... I had to go to college, according to my mother, like my brothers. I didn't ever want to leave my dad or my dad's ranch. My dad was the manager of the 45,000-acre ranch, but he owned his own 1,200-acre ranch, and I owned four cattle that he gave to me when I graduated from grammar school from the eighth grade. And those cows multiplied, and he kept track of them for years for me, and that was my herd.
You know, I'm used to seeing you behind the piano. It's hard for me to imagine you as a cowboy.
Well, I could send you pictures. And there even are some what we call movies in those days, some of the very first kind of home movies where I'm with my dad, lassing and branding and big roundup. So it is documented.
Did you sing cowboy songs?
All of them. Yeah. When there were real cowboy songs like Strawberry Roan and Little Joe the Wrangler, tunes that people don't sing anymore. I love those songs. The words can still make me cry, and I used to make my kids cry by singing, Joe, you take my saddle. Bill, you take my bed. Jim, you take my pistol after I am dead. And think of me, please, kindly, when you look upon them all, for I'll not see my mother when the work's all done next fall. Now, that's a cowboy tune.
Did you like singing?
Oh, yeah. I used to sing that, play my ukulele.
Ukulele? No, wow.
Some of my friends played guitar, cowboy songs, yeah.
Let me get back to what we were talking about, which was life on the cattle ranch. And there were two cattle ranches in your life, the one your father owned and the larger one that he managed. Did you have really strong arms and hands from the work, and do you think that that helped you as a piano player?
It didn't hurt. My mother would not allow my dad to have me rope anything larger than a yearling because she didn't want my fingers to become hurt. And my uncle, who was also a rodeo roper, got his finger caught between the saddle horn and the rope, and it took his finger right off. And he used to kid the other cowboys and said, I would have been a great pianist like my nephew Dave had I not lost his finger.
Was your mother convinced that you were going to become a pianist, or she was just worried about your fingers on general principles?
Well, she thought that I had a certain amount of talent that I was not developing. And so after my first year as a veterinary pre-med, I switched to the music department, which was across the lawn.
Mm-hmm.
And that was at the advice of my zoology teacher, Dr. Arnold. He said, Brubeck, your mind is not here. With these frogs and the formaldehyde. Your mind's across the lawn at the conservatory. Will you please go over there next year?
How did he know?
I guess he just seen me become kind of blank and be listening to everybody practicing and the music and drifting away from what he was trying to teach me.
No, I think in spite of the fact that you studied piano with your mother as a boy, you weren't very good at reading music. How well could you read when you started majoring in music in college?
I couldn't read. And that caused a lot of trouble in the conservatory. So I hid it until I was a senior by not taking piano. I'd take the other instruments were cello and clarinet, and so that I was just playing scales and getting by and doing the subjects I had to pass in. But in my senior year, they said, you have to take piano. And the piano teacher, in 5 minutes, ran downstairs to the dean and said, Brubeck can't read at all. So the dean said, you know, you're a disgrace to the conservatory and we can't graduate you. And when some of the younger teachers heard this, they went to the dean and they said, you're making a big mistake because he writes the best counterpoint that I've ever had, said Dr. Brown. And Dr. Bodley went in and said, you're wrong. You know, this guy is talented. So they convinced the dean to let me graduate. And the dean said, you can graduate if you promise never to teach and embarrass the conservatory. So that's the way I graduated. And that's the way I've gotten through life as having to substitute other things for not being able to read well. But I can write, which is something very few people understand.
I thought we might pause here and listen to another recently re-released recording. And this features you with the great singer Jimmy Rushing. Now, you haven't done a lot of work with singers over the years, at least not that I'm aware of. Tell me how you managed to do this session with Jimmy Rushing, who had sung with Basie. And he's considered a great blues singer, but he's also a great singer of swing tunes and standards.
I was on tour with Jimmy in England, and we had to take the train together to the next city. So we were riding in the train for about 3 hours, and he said, "Dave, I want to do an album with you." And I said, "I don't think I'm the right group for you, Jimmy." And he said, "I know you're the right group. I've been listening to you for years. And I'm going to set this up at Columbia Records as soon as we get back."
Why don't we hear you and Jimmy Rushing doing "There'll Be Some Changes Made"?
Oh.
You like that?
Yeah.
Yes, so do I. And this is from the recently reissued 1960 recording Brubeck and Rushing, the Dave Brubeck Quartet, featuring Jimmy Rushing.
There's a change in the weather, change in the sea. From now on there'll be a change in me. Walk will be different, mind talking my name. Nothing about me's gonna be the same. Change my long tone for a little short fat. Change my number where I'm stopping at. Nobody wants you when you're old and gray. There'll be some changes made today. There'll be some changes made. Change in the sea. From now on there'll be a change in me. What will be different, my talk and my name. Nothing about me's gonna be the same. Change my long tone for a little short fat. Change my number where I'm stopping at. Nobody wants you when you're old and gray. There'll be some changes made today.
Moving along with the story of your life, you were in the Army, I think, toward the end of World War II. Did you see combat?
I saw it.
Okay. Didn't participate, huh?
I avoided participation. But, I was in the Battle of the Bulge, and I was on the wrong side of the lines. I was in German territory.
How did you end up in German territory?
We didn't know where we were. And everything was going wrong. And so the truck driver just took the wrong turn. And I was up there to play a show for the frontline troops with my band, which were all infantry guys that had been wounded. When I say all, most of the guys in my band had been wounded. And when they'd come back behind the lines, if they were musicians, the doctors would send them to me or the who was ever interviewing them. So I had a good band, and a band that was very accepted at the front line, because if you were your Purple Heart. The frontline guys are hard to reach. The USO people usually didn't go up that close, and also they would have trouble reaching guys that in the morning were going to face a terrible kind of life. But my guys could reach them because they'd been there since D-Day. Some of them had been 3 months at the front. And so it made it a lot easier for the soldiers to accept my band.
After the war was over, you went back to college on the GI Bill, and I think it was then that you studied with the French composer Darius Milhaud. Had you known Milhaud's work very well?
Well, my brother was his assistant, Howard. Oh. And just before I went into the Army, I went to see Milhaud and ask him if, when I got out, I could come back and study with him. And he said I could. So that's exactly what I did. On the GI Bill, I went directly after I got out of the Army back to Mills College and studied with him.
And were you expecting then to write classical music?
Yeah. And he would tell me, don't give up jazz. He said, you can do that so well. Why do you want to give it up and become a classical composer? And so we discussed that a lot. And then he said, look, if you're going to compose, you have to use the jazz idiom or you won't represent this country. And he said, my favorite composers are Duke Ellington and George Gershwin. And this really surprised me because you wouldn't have heard that probably any other conservatory in the country. But you see, Milhaud was the first guy, first European composer, to use the jazz idiom in classical music, a piece called The Creation of the World, a ballet. So he would say, don't ever give up jazz. You're free. You can go any place in the world where there's a piano and you can play and you can make a living and you don't have to teach or do some of the things that other composers have to do in order to survive. And he said, and the worst thing you want to get out of is our faculty meetings. And I think that's a good reason not to become a teacher in a university or college.
So it sounds like he gave you some good advice.
Oh, yeah. He said, travel the world, keep your ears open, bring back everything you hear, put it in the jazz idiom. And that's what I did. I still follow his advice.
Well, I want to play a 1956 recording, and this is your recording of The Duke, which you've described as your tribute to both Duke Ellington and Darius Milhaud.
Right.
And Ellington also, was wonderful at connecting classical form and jazz. You want to say anything else about this composition before we hear it?
Well, it is one of my favorite compositions, and the second theme is where I use Milhaud kind of influences with polytonality, which wasn't being done too much in early jazz. It was being done some, but Milhaud was a master of that. And then the first part is just kind of my impression of Duke's wonderful band.
Let's hear it. This is The Duke, composed and performed by my guest, Dave Brubeck. Thank you.
Before we rejoin Terry's conversation with Dave Brubeck, let's listen to another track. From the 1955 album Brubeck Time, this song was composed by Brubeck and alto saxophonist Paul Desmond. It's called Audrey.
The recording we just heard was released 45 years ago, which was the same year that you were on the cover of Time magazine. What was the impact of this recording, Brubeck Time, on your career?
Well, it's a wonderful time in my life because we had been struggling for years to get to be more known. And as you mentioned, the cover of Time magazine was really something that helped us a lot. But when you mentioned Audrey, it was Audrey Hepburn that we had in mind. And we never realized that that she ever had heard this tune. There was no communication like that. And because she was so important at the United Nations for the work she did with children, when they did a memorial service for her there, her husband asked that they play what you just played. And they said that she usually played it every night or put it on her headphones as she walked through her garden in Switzerland. So it was wonderful to hear that. I wish Paul Desmond had been around to know that she listened to it and liked it.
Now, how is the recording Brubeck Time different from your previous recordings?
Well, at that time, I was starting to do different time signatures, but the record companies were kind of leery of getting out of the usual dance tempos that were mostly 4/4. And an occasional waltz. So eventually, after Brubeck Time, we did Time Out, which had Take Five and Blue Rondo and Three to Get Ready. And again, the record companies were a little afraid of it. But against their wishes, I forced them to put Time Out out. And it became the biggest seller they ever had in jazz.
Now, your first record that I think really made an impression on the record-buying public, I mean, it got bought a lot, was A Jazz Goes to College.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sessions recorded at three different colleges.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a picture of you on it, and you're wearing your glasses. And those glasses were really such a part of your image. And I think in part because that record was Jazz Goes to College, and in part because of those kind of thick plastic glasses, you maybe had the image of being what was known in those days as an egghead?
I wish I had. I'm not that smart. But people forget that at the same time, we had a huge following at places like the Apollo Theater,
mm-hmm.
the Howard Theater in Washington, and the universities that they used to call black universities, Afro-American universities. We played the so-called black clubs all through the South, where no white people came in. And in some of the black clubs, we were the only white group that came in. This is what I wish people would remember.
Mm-hmm.
And we integrated many, many universities in this country. And those are important things to remember. It wasn't just Ivy League places. We were really doing some work that people seem to forget how hard it was to do, where you had to have a police escort to the concert. The president of the college refusing to let you go on, and the students demanding you go on. I could tell you a lot of stories about that.
The problem was that you were white, or that one of the musicians in the band was black?
Eugene Wright was black, yeah.
So that was the problem.
And we couldn't do some television shows, because in those days you couldn't have black and white together. One show I had to turn down, Duke Ellington took, because at the moment he had an all-black band. Sometimes Duke would have a white drummer like Louis Belson, and that would maybe give him problems. They just didn't want mixed groups on television.
Let me play what might be the most famous of the Brubeck Quartet recordings, and that's Take Five, which you recorded in 1959. Would you talk about this composition? It's a Desmond composition, but I think you worked with him on it.
Yeah. Paul has done a radio show in Canada before he died, where he said, "I'm so fortunate that Dave assigned me to do the section in 5/4, because that was the one track I wanted Paul to do as a solo for my percussionist, the great drummer Joe Morello, because Joe would often play in 5/4 time backstage, which is a time signature that was very rarely, if ever, used in jazz. So I would hear Paul start to improvise over Joe playing on a drum pad before you'd go on stage. And so I said, just write some of the melodies, the ideas that you're doing, and bring it to rehearsal in a few days. So that's what happened. He came and he had some ideas that I thought were great. The first thing he said, "I can't write anything in 5/4. I've tried and tried." I said, "Let me see what you got." So he showed me what he had, and I said, "I can put this together, and it'll be great." And I put what he had together as theme one, theme two, and that's how the thing was born. And I named it Take Five, and he objected to that name. And I said, "Why, Paul?" And he said, "Nobody knows what Take Five means. What does it mean?" I said, "Everybody knows but you, Paul Desmond, what Take Five means." So I argued with him, and I kept that title, which I think is a great title. Then, of course, I later wrote the words to it. So I had a little bit to do with this tune.
Well, before we hear it, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your early career. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
And this is Take Five, the Dave Brubeck Quartet, recorded in 1959. Thank you.
That's the Dave Brubeck Quartet playing Take Five. He spoke with Terry Gross in 1999. Brubeck turns 90 years old on Monday, and we send him warm birthday greetings. On his birthday, Turner Classic Movies will present Clint Eastwood's new documentary about Brubeck. For the jazz lover on your gift list, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has some ideas, which include CDs, books, and a DVD.
If you want to have fun, come home with me. You can stay all night and play with my TV. TV is the thing this year, TV is the thing this year. Radio was great, now it's out of date. TV is the thing this year.
Dinah Washington, 1953, when bongos were also a thing. The gospel-trained singer doesn't have the cachet of her contemporaries Ella Fitzgerald or Sarah Vaughan, but Washington's records had an earthier, scrappier feel. Her emotional delivery and ironic detachment influenced singers as diverse as Aretha Franklin and Nancy Wilson. Washington could sing anything with conviction, and her producers made her prove it, chasing hits in every niche market they could think of. On the new 4-CD set, the fabulous Miss D, the Keynote, Decca, and Mercury singles, 1943 to 1953, she sings about bawdy encounters with her TV repairman and dentist, and does ballads with strings, slick big band blues, early rock and roll, a calypso in Jamaican dialect, Silent Night, and a little Hank Williams.
In anger, unkind words are said. That makes the teardrop start. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart?
There aren't so many blockbuster jazz reissues this season, but there are a couple of worthy coffee table books to give a jazz fan or ask for yourself. The esteemed, recently deceased photographer Herman Leonard's book, simply called Jazz, showcases his sharply focused, high-contrast black-and-white pictures. They include iconic images of Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, Dexter Gordon, Ella Fitzgerald, Chet Baker, and the young and older Miles Davis, all crisply reproduced. In an interview, Leonard talks about the technical problems of shooting dark-skinned musicians in dim, smoky rooms, and also how much of his success relied on gaining musicians' trust. Photographer John Abbott has developed that kind of rapport with Sonny Rollins since the early 90s. The book Saxophone Colossus, a portrait of Sonny Rollins, spotlights Abbott's bright color photographs of the saxophonist as white-bearded patriarch. But it's worth having just for Rollins-ologist Bob Blumenthal's extended essay, which looks at the 1956 LP Saxophone Colossus as a microcosm of Sonny's career. The text and images, surveying Rollins in two time periods, create a kind of musical counterpoint. Sonny's playing in the 50s was a marvel of brash authority and pithy wit. To give a curious listener a quick intro, try this year's double CD, The Definitive Sonny Rollins on Prestige, Riverside, and Contemporary. This is Blue 7. If you know a young drummer who needs a push in a creative direction, there's the DVD Billy Martin's Life on Drums, where Modesky Martin and Wood's percussionist talks less about specific techniques than how to think about the drums as an instrument and part of an ensemble. The DVD's method is part of the message. Talking with his teacher, Alan Herman, Martin demonstrates how to take time to develop your main themes and how you gotta listen and leave room. There's a winning moment when he catches himself hogging the conversation. And Martin's solos contain a wealth of good ideas and visual information. In the first episode of HBO's Tremé, a character rails against yet another New Orleans music anthology that's just like all the others. That set the bar a little higher for Tremé's own satisfying Shaggy soundtrack CD. There's some music by actors performing in character, Mardi Gras Indians singing on the street, and songs by local luminaries from Louis Prima to Kermit Ruffins. New Orleans brass bands are where diverse musical strains really flow together. The post-Katrina Free Agents Brass Band brings together marches, jazz, R&B, gospel, and more.
On that bridge, so let's get it how we live. That's why we did what we did. When I lost my city, almost lost my mind. In and out of hotels, feel like I'm doing time. Please, Mr. Officer, don't shoot, cause I ain't eating theirs. I was stuck up on that roof, ain't trying to make an excuse, but they're running from the truth. We know they blew them levers, man, but we ain't got no proof. Whatever.
On the Tremé soundtrack, as in New Orleans music generally, you can trace the roots of American vernaculars way back to West Africa and Old Europe. The city's contemporary music speaks to the universal siblinghood of humanity and the power of faith in new beginnings. And aren't those the messages we need to hear this time of year?
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. Director Darren Aronofsky's fifth feature, Black Swan, is set in the world of a New York City ballet company. Natalie Portman stars as an up-and-coming dancer struggling to master her first leading role in Swan Lake. Our film critic, David Edelstein, has this review.
In Black Swan, Natalie Portman's young ballerina Nina is a candidate to dance the Swan Queen in Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, but her company's artistic director, Tomas, played by Vincent Cassell, maintains she's only suited for half the double role. She's the very embodiment, he says, of the innocent white swan, but for the dark, demonic twin, she's too childlike, repressed. Like a method acting guru, Tomas exhorts her to lose control, surrender to her sexuality, preferably with him.
In 4 years, every time you dance, I see you obsessed, getting each and every move perfectly right, but I never see you lose yourself. Ever. All that discipline for what?
Just want to be perfect.
You what?
Want to be perfect.
Perfection is not just about control. It's also about letting go. Surprise yourself so you can surprise the audience. Transcendence. And very few have it in them.
I think I do have it in.
Ah! You bit me? I can't believe you bit me.
I'm sorry.
Nina bit his lip, and you'd think that would put the kibosh on her chances of playing the Swan Queen. But no, Tomas likes this biting, blood-drawing Nina, and he casts her in the role. But his challenge lingers. Can this sexually immature young woman who lives with an infantilizing mother in a pink bedroom surrounded by stuffed animals become the Black Swan? The writer and director, Darren Aronofsky, dramatizes vividly, feverishly, expressionistically, Nina's transformation into a more sexualized creature and the visions that accompany that transformation. The camera follows about a foot behind her slender neck as the locations change and doppelgangers pop up left and right. Reflections of Nina in mirrors take on a life of their own. icky, feathery things sprout from her flesh. There are bloody assaults that might or might not be real. Black Swan is a virtuosic piece of filmmaking, a tour de force, and also, I think, a camp classic, like Showgirls, remade by Roman Polanski. You could have a great time laughing at it and its goofy, Freudian method acting cliches if it weren't so bludgeoning. Aronofsky's aesthetic can be easily stated. He wants to give you a drug experience. In his terrific first feature, Pi, the protagonist became obsessed with a mathematical equation, and his mental convolutions were right there in the camera work and cutting. While in his Requiem for a Dream, pills and heroin dictated the fractured syntax. In The Wrestler, Aronofsky crafted an ode to male masochism, to the notion that a man is only truly ecstatically alive on the brink of self-obliteration. Black Swan is the wrestler's female masochistic counterpoint, and on its own terms, the film is perfectly worked out. But like most drug experiences, it's largely empty sensation. It leaves little behind but a hangover. Portman gives the kind of performance that wins awards, largely because you're so aware of her sacrifices to play the part. She lost a ton of weight, and for an actress, dances well, although not brilliantly or distinctively enough to convince you that the company director would single her out. When she finally becomes the Black Swan, she does have a great, glittery-eyed, demonic look, and Aronofsky brings her bony face with its black-rimmed eyes into the camera like a close-up of a shrunken head. It is, as Count Floyd on SCTV used to say, "Ooh, scary, kids!" And a lot of critics and festival audiences have been wowed, dazzled, freaked out. When the movie is over, it takes a long time to purge Tchaikovsky from your brain. But if you're a dance lover, I don't think you'll love Black Swan. Although Nina tells Tomas that her goal is perfection, she doesn't really mean artistic perfection. I've never seen a dance movie with so little appreciation for the art of dance. Early on, even before Nina loses it, the camera seems to be shuddering in horror with every spin, and the dancers are all scary-looking, angry, emaciated women with dark hair severely pulled back, twisting and cracking their limbs, puppets of Tomas, that tyrannical male deity. But I left thinking the tyrannical male deity was Aronofsky, and that his vision, in the end, is no more complex or enlivening than a cheap hack-em-up director's, treating your head in the manner of another Tchaikovsky title character, the Nutcracker.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hersfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.